You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Stanley McChrystal was following in his father's footsteps when he went to West Point and set out for a career in the military. During his notable career, he led the Joint Special Operations Command from 2003 to 2008, and he's credited with transforming U.S. Special Operations into an effective counterterrorism force. And then he served as commanding officer for all U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan until 2010, when he was forced to step down from that post by President Obama after General McChrystal was quoted criticizing the White House in an article in Rolling Stone. He retired in 2010 as a four-star Army general. Now he's written a memoir, My Share of the Task, which is published by Portfolio Penguin. He's currently a senior fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs and co-founder of the McChrystal Group, a leadership consulting firm. I'm very pleased to welcome General Stanley McChrystal to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
On September 11, 2001, what did you know about Al-Qaeda?
Well, it's interesting. I knew quite a lot on an academic sense because we were aware of the bombings in East Africa, the two embassies. I was aware, of course, of the strikes that President Clinton had launched into Sudan and into Afghanistan against reported locations of those. I was aware of the coal bombing, and I had done some reading on Al-Qaeda. I had served in Kuwait in June of 2001 during a period of a lot of reported threats to Americans and to American military locations. But to be honest, although I viewed him and Al-Qaeda as a specific terrorist threat, like many Americans, I don't think I had an appreciation for the breadth of it or just how serious they were to try to strike as they did on 9/11.
You describe Al-Qaeda as, quote, an organization, an idea, and most recently a brand. How does that make it different from other enemies that the U.S. military has faced?
Well, it's interesting. If I talk about nation states we fought in wars, that's pretty straightforward. But some of the other groups that we might have fought or been impacted by, terrorist groups, tended to be fairly narrowly focused, politically oriented terrorist groups, finite in number, very wrapped around a single issue that it wanted. This was a bit different. They didn't want a single thing. They wanted an idea to establish an Islamic caliphate in the region, and they wanted the West out of the region. And those goals were so expansive, at first they seemed laughable, but in reality, they were anything but that.
Is part of the fight against Al-Qaeda involved in discrediting the idea part of their mission, undermining that brand?
I think that has to be the core of it.
And have we been at all successful?
Well, I think we have been a little bit successful. They have actually helped us with that. In many ways, Al-Qaeda, their basic doctrine is fairly nihilistic. It argues a return to 7th century values and mores, and most of the region is not interested in that. Also, the way that they have operated, attacks, and in many cases, people who carried their message, like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi inside Iraq, were so bloodthirsty that I think it caused many people to recoil from them. But I don't think we, the West, have been particularly effective in helping to make an argument that we can be partners with a very responsible Islamic, the Islamic majority in the region.
Our approach seems to have been to kill off as many people in the leadership as possible, but that doesn't mean that we are going to kill off Al-Qaeda.
Well, as you correctly said, Al-Qaeda is as much an idea and a brand as it is a concrete group of people anymore or even a specific network. Most of the places where we see Al-Qaeda rising now, like Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb in North Africa or in Yemen or in the Horn of Africa, are very self-contained. They get some guidance from leadership in Pakistan, but they don't get resources from there. They really don't exchange leaders. They're pretty self-sufficient, but they do ride the brand, and the brand gives them some legitimacy. And so they're able to leverage this idea that you have a wider, credible outrage against the West And it gives them credibility that their small element might not have otherwise.
It is interesting that you mention North Africa and Pakistan, because right now we're facing all sorts of problems in Mali, in Algeria, and in Pakistan. Just coincidentally.
Right. Yeah, and we're going to keep facing problems there. This is not going to be a story of the week or month. I think it's going to be a story of the decade.
When you first went to Afghanistan in May 2002, what was the situation there?
Well, the country, as we arrived, they had been at war then for about 23 years, and various kinds of war, the Soviet intervention, and then there had been broken, as you know, the Najibullah regime survived for three more years, so continued that fight. Then they broke into this really vicious civil war, and it was kind of dividing the spoils among the warlord-led groups, the Mujahideen groups. And then in 1996, really a little bit before that, the Taliban started to come in, and they tried, or they were perceived as a, as I put in the book, a spring rain to wash away the dust and dirt and the predations of these warlords. But the effect for the average Afghan was the country was physically devastated, the people were morally or psychologically traumatized, and all the old familiar institutions from the tribes to the relationship, to the monarchy, those were all torn asunder. So everything that they were familiar with was essentially gone or badly corrupted. And we entered there in the spring of 2002, and it just struck me that this was a society. It wasn't Afghanistan. If you think of Afghanistan in its traditional sense, that hadn't existed since about 1978. And it was this mutated place that needed to repair itself.
Well, when you arrived at the Pentagon to the joint staff in August 2002, was it a surprise to you that the focus was more on Iraq and on Saddam Hussein than on Afghanistan?
Yeah, I outline this in a fair amount of detail in the book because I came out of Afghanistan where I had been focused, obviously, on al-Qaeda, but also on our trying to move ahead in Afghanistan and achieve greater stability. And then I found a focus on contemplation of an invasion of Iraq. And at first, I didn't think it was serious. I thought it was contingency planning. And I think most of us did. And it wasn't until about Christmas, when a lot of preparation had done, did I become convinced that American policy was very serious about potentially intervening in Iraq.
Were you concerned about our preparedness as it became more apparent that the invasion of Iraq was going to happen?
I wasn't concerned about our military preparedness. I thought that I'd been in the first Gulf War and then in Afghanistan. I knew that militarily it was not going to be particularly difficult to defeat Saddam Hussein's forces. I was very concerned about what we didn't know, what we didn't appreciate about the latent forces inside Iraq. There were sectarian tensions between Sunni, Shia, and then, of course, the Kurds that we were aware of, but we were not really deeply informed on. It's one thing to know they exist. It's another to understand that the players are likely to react. We didn't understand things like the electrical grid. We didn't know how fragile that was. And so I think we went in much less informed than we should have been.
Well, I remember reading predictions of all the problems that we were likely to face, and they were all pretty accurate. They were passed on and then ignored. Why do you think they were ignored by the people who made the final decisions?
That's a great question, and I certainly can't tell you why. I don't think that we did. Again, the information was there to inform ourselves and to better shape our policy, but I think that the military got very focused on what we call phase three, which is decisive operations, the destruction of Saddam Hussein's forces and capture of military installations. We talk about phase four. That's what you do afterward. That's establishing order, rebuilding the country. I think very short shrift was given to the very detailed effort that was going to be required there.
My guest is General Stanley McChrystal. His memoir, My Share of the Task, published by Portfolio Penguin. Has Iraq been largely forgotten these days? It seems to me that Americans tend to have a short attention span with certain events, perhaps because it didn't turn out the way that we had hoped. So it's better to just put it all behind us.
I think we do have a national tendency to do that. And whether it turns out well or badly, I think we tend to do it either way. But we also tend to not internalize some of the lessons we may have learned from the experience. And I think that Iraq may fall into that. I think we're going to hear a lot more about Iraq in the next decade. I don't think that this is going to be one that we will turn our back on and forget. If you remember the experience of Vietnam, we went there, and then after that turned out badly, really that region minded itself for the next 20 or so years till Vietnam has emerged into a new state. I don't think that's going to be true of the Mideast over the next decade.
Did everyone in the military believe that Saddam Hussein had those weapons of mass destruction?
I certainly can't speak for everyone in the military. I think the interesting thing to consider is, one, he had a history of weapons of mass destruction, you know, with the fact he'd used them against his own people and whatnot. And he was acting like he had them. Now, at the time, you look at it and you say, well, why would he act this way with the inspectors and whatnot if he didn't have them? It turned out that I think the best assessment is that he was nervous to admit that he didn't have them because of his potential foes internally in Iran. So he wanted them to believe he had that, and it created the bad outcome that we believed he had them. Now, interestingly, I remember sitting in intelligence briefings. I never heard an intelligence officer in the military, in the Pentagon, where I was at the time, say that he had them. I heard one officer once say, when he was asked directly, he says, listen, sir, I don't have any intelligence that confirms he's got them. All I can tell you is he had this history and he acts like he has them. But he looked the people in the eye and said, but I can't confirm or deny, and that's where we are.
And we had Hans Blix on the show who said, I go wherever the U.S. tells me to go to find these weapons, and there are no weapons. They can't move them out that fast. But I guess we believe what we wanted to believe. Do you think that the war in Iraq ended up keeping resources and intelligence from Afghanistan and set back our efforts there?
Oh, absolutely. When you talk about military effort, there's a certain finite resources of military forces, intelligence assets, predator unmanned aerial vehicles, things which are very important, but also just attention, you know, leadership's attention, national level attention, things like that. And when I got to Afghanistan in the summer of 2009, it was clear that that theater had been under-resourced in terms of talent, in terms of information technology infrastructure, in terms of forces as well.
You led Task Force 714 in Iraq beginning in 2004. What was your mission?
Well, we were initially focused against Saddam Hussein's former regime cronies, the deck of cards you probably remember. And for the first two or three months, we were focused on cleaning that up because that was the perception of the biggest problem. And we captured Saddam Hussein in December of that year. Very quickly thereafter, and I cover this in detail in the book, because right about the end of December 2003, we developed a clear intelligence picture that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a Jordanian who became eventually the senior leader for al-Qaeda in Iraq, we realized that not only was he in country, but he was already establishing an effective network. He ultimately, it took us 2.5 years of an intense manhunt to get him, but also it took us even longer to dismantle the very extensive network he built.
You write that in 2003, TF-714's product was your shooters, but by the end it was your network. Can you describe that network?
Well, I sure can. And what I mean by that is when we started, we were a raid force, and we were the best in the world. We could do precision raids on a target, great operators that executed great aviators and whatnot. But that turned out to be insufficient for the threat. We weren't dealing with a few people that we could go and kill or capture key leaders. We were dealing with this booming al-Qaeda slash Sunni network inside Iraq, and it also reached across the region. So what we had to do, we realized, is we had to dismantle their network, not just try to decapitate it. So we built a network, which included physically a number of bases around the country, some very small, some larger. And then we built a very robust information technology backbone so we could push information, and we exploded the amount of bandwidth that we used so we could push imagery, audio, interviews and things like that. And then we put our forces out and we decentralized the way we operate. We created an entity that sucked in information, but then shared that information across our internal network in real time. And then we decentralized decision making so that at each location, rather than having to come up the chain and ask for permission to conduct an operation, they could operate very quickly and pull that information back and feed the network again. As a consequence, in August of 2004, we did 18 raids, my force, in all of Iraq. 2 years later, as we had expanded not really the number of our assault force as much, but this network of information, we were doing 300 raids a month, and we kept that up for more than 2 years. That's 10 a night. And so I used to joke to people, I said, we used to be a bookshop, and we became Amazon.com.
My guest is Stanley McChrystal, who retired general in July 2010 as a four-star general of the U.S. Army. He's written a memoir called My Share of the Task. It is published by Portfolio Penguin. When we come back, we'll find out why the lessons of Iraq didn't always work as well in Afghanistan. We'll talk about the current situation in that country and everything else that we can get to in the next 20 minutes. Stay with us. We are back with retired General Stanley McChrystal. He has written a memoir called My Share of the Task. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. You write, I know the moral and political traps awaiting forces conducting counterinsurgency operatives, and I wanted to confront them directly before we found ourselves acting in ways counter to our values and our cause. Well, you faced a lot of problems over the years, Abu Ghraib when you were in Iraq, and then just yesterday, Marine Sergeant Edward Deptola pleaded guilty in court to desecrating the bodies of dead Taliban fighters posing for trophy photos. We have Robert Bales, whose court-martial begins today, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales. He might get the death penalty for the murders of 16 Afghan civilians and the shooting of six others. And then there's just the problem of the high number of civilian casualties in the normal course of events. I'm not sure that there's a question there. I guess the question is that a moral or political trap?
Yeah, that's a great one to talk about. Let me kind of wrap these all together because it's all of those things. First off, when you have an insurgency, and in reality, Al-Qaeda is a regional insurgency as opposed to just a terrorist group, it's really an argument. It's analogous to an argument between two people, but it's an argument between two sides, the insurgents and the government, or the counterinsurgents. And they're arguing, and the people watching and evaluating this argument are the population. And they are deciding which argument is most convincing and therefore whom they will confer legitimacy on. It's a kinetic argument sometimes, because sometimes it's just not who's more convincing in terms of has a better line, but also who can bring coercion and who can show that they can win. But as part of that argument, as each side conducts operations, they try to convince people, and sometimes they try to discredit their opponents. Insurgents typically, if they are good, will conduct operations to get the government or counterinsurgent to overreact. And I used to tell a force it was a little bit like a matador. He waves a cape and causes the bull to charge at the cape. Well, insurgents will sometimes go into an area and they'll shoot from a building in a block. And what they want you to do is they want you to overreact. They want you to bomb the house, or they want you to surround the block and search everybody's apartment and arrest a bunch of people, because although you may capture the insurgent, what you've really done is you've irritated all the population against you. And so the insurgent is seeking overreaction, just like the terrorist is. The terrorist wants you to put it on the front page of the paper. The terrorists want you to inconvenience people with new security measures. The terrorists want you to do things which undercuts your credibility. And sometimes we play into that. When you bring in forces, one of the things that's particularly in an Islamic country, you run the risk of having antibodies created just by your presence. And then every time you do something wrong that plays into a perception or a negative perception, Abu Ghraib was the worst thing that happened to America in the whole time we were in the region. because although we view it as a single group of immature guards acting criminally and an aberrant, you know, act of cruelty, in fact, many people in the region use that as proof positive that America was every bit as negative as some of the propaganda had been saying. And so we would fight hundreds and thousands of young foreign fighters who came from North Africa, Syria, Saudi Arabia, who flooded into Iraq to join the jihad because they were morally outraged at the photographs they'd seen from Abu Ghraib, because they thought that was the standard practice. Then you take things like the murders that Sergeant Bales is accused of having committed in Afghanistan. The enemy leverages that and says, look what the Americans do. And then civilian casualties. There was an interesting thing that I outline in pretty much detail in the book, because when Afghans saw Americans come to Afghanistan in 2001, they saw this incredible demonstration of precision air power. We would hit Taliban and al-Qaeda positions as though we were omniscient and omnipotent. Later in the wars, we operate more, and we do an airstrike and hit Afghan civilians by mistake. They go back to that previous perception, and they say, wait a minute, you hit Afghan civilians, but you're omniscient and you're omnipotent. You must be trying to hit Afghan civilians, or you are so casual with Afghan lives that you don't care. And it convinced them that even though we say we're here to liberate you and protect you, they're trying to say, well, how is blowing up my house and how is killing civilians congruent with that? And it's a very logical, rational argument for the people to make, or conclusion for the people to draw. And that's what makes this kind of operation so difficult. Every bone in your body, when you come upon a torture cell or you see the murder of car bomb set off, makes you want to reach out and react very, very strongly militarily. You want to bomb something, you want to kill somebody. And, I mean, that's a natural reaction. I had a lot of people telling me, we're not fighting hard enough. Well, we were working hard enough in the only way you could win the war, which is winning the people. But it's very easy to forget that.
Well, how do you win over the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, the Shiites, the Iraqis the Iraqis have the Sunni-Shiite split in Afghanistan. There seem to be a whole bunch of splits, city versus country, Pashtun versus Hazara, and there are all sorts of other groups, all that seem to want something different. So how do you develop a strategy for dealing with all of those different people pulling at you?
Yeah, I go back to my point. People act rationally, the vast majority do, and they don't react to an emotional argument that comes and says, we are nicer people than the Taliban, therefore your hearts and minds should come with us. People don't react that way. You confer legitimacy on whichever government meets your needs, whether they provide security, whether they provide rule of law, whether they provide basic services and things like that. And you don't have to love your government, but you pay taxes to it if it does those basic things for you. So what you've got to do is you've got to go into an area and convince the people that you are going to be able to create an environment that better meets their needs than the insurgents can. And in Afghanistan, for example, the Taliban were very good about doing traveling justice. They brought adjudicators like judges to an area, and they would very rapidly do court cases. And they weren't all Islamic morality cases. Many of them were adjudicating land disputes. And they would come in and they'd do it very quickly, and they were relatively fair at it. And yet the government of Afghanistan, its court system was ineffective for the large part and corrupt in most places. So the Taliban would show, look, we're giving you one of the basic services you need. What you got to do is, this is what makes it so hard. You can't fake your way through it. You can't use some propaganda slogans or anything like that. You got to come in and meet basic needs, starting with security, protecting them from being killed.
But obviously, one of the problems, a major problem, as you suggest, is the corruption in the Afghan government. My guest is General Stanley McChrystal. His memoir, My Share of the Task, published by Portfolio Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So how do you deal with that corruption and the ineffectiveness of the government?
Yeah, the corruption, I mean, there's always been a level of corruption in many countries in the world, Afghanistan included. It really exploded during the civil wars and during the period after that because the normal structures of society had broken down. So people got in the take care of myself and my family first mode. And so corruption became, it rose to a level that even Afghans in all parts of society were actually pretty upset about. So the first thing you got to do is you got to make it work in a non-corrupt way. You got to give people an option. I used the narcotics to show that. A farmer in Helmand province, for example, made just as much money growing wheat or pomegranate as they would growing poppies, opium. But when their security is bad and they can't move their goods to market easily, or they are subjected to shakedowns at a number of checkpoints en route to market, then suddenly they don't make any money. But the opium dealer delivers opium poppy seeds to the farm, and then when they have harvested the opium paste, the trafficker picks it up right at the farm. So the farmer can make money, but he doesn't have to go through the security on the roads. He'd rather make money legally, but if his option is between making no money by trying to raise wheat or making some money by opium, there's no choice. It's a rational act.
What about, President Hamid Karzai was in Washington last week, and President Obama announced that starting in the spring, U.S. forces will serve only as a supporting role in Afghanistan, allowing for the withdrawal of troops to begin and for the Afghan security forces to become more responsible. What are your thoughts on how many troops should remain and what their role should be going forward?
I wouldn't opine on a number because I'm not close enough to it, and there are people much more informed on the ground now who are. But I would say that the Afghan people are frightened, and they're frightened because there has been a lot of progress since 2001. David Ignatius wrote a great piece in the Washington Post today where he outlined a lot of the progress. But that really heightens the fear of Afghans who are afraid that if America and the West leave completely in 2014, and if their government is not strong enough and not legitimate enough to maintain those gains, that they'll backslide. I think what we need to do is, one, make a basic decision whether Afghanistan matters to us. And I think from a standpoint of preventing an al-Qaeda safe haven, it does. But I'd make a much bigger argument that security or stability in that region has a real effect on us. And long-term, and of course, neighbors to Pakistan and Iran, matters a lot. So if we decide that a stable Afghanistan is in America's geostrategic interests, then I think we figure out what we have to do to help ensure that. I think that's a strategic partnership with Afghanistan that's not a lot of forces, not a huge amount of money, but it's a reliable relationship, a partnership that the Afghans believe in. The Afghans believe that they saw us leave in 1989. We had supported the Mujahideen. Then we essentially turned our back on the region, and they believe they were abandoned. Now, they made a lot of mistakes in the intervening years, but they think that they fought against our Cold War enemies, the Russians, lost 1.2 million Afghans, and then we walked away. They're afraid to see that again. I think that we could offer a partnership that is credible enough and reliable enough that would give them the confidence to do it themselves, because they've got to do it themselves ultimately. They've got to protect their own sovereignty.
But as I brought up earlier, there are differences within the Afghan people. And as I understand it, the people in the city generally want to see the changes that the United States has brought with it remain in place. People in the country, on the countryside, might not. Is it possible to keep a unified Afghanistan going?
I'm smiling because as I look in the United States, there are actually some pretty big differences in the United States, and there's some pretty widely diverse opinions on some key issues, and yet we do hold it together.
So you're saying there are red states and blue states in Afghanistan as well?
More or less. That's true. There are people that see things very differently. The key thing is that they all have to see, whether they disagree or not, they're still better off if they're part of the larger whole. That's the key point.
Well, in Iraq, one of the ways that we helped ourselves was by buying off insurgents. That doesn't seem to have worked as much in Afghanistan. Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. I don't think buying off insurgents is what worked in Iraq. I think a couple of things happened. First, the Sunnis who were supporting the insurgency came to the conclusion, one, that the United States had been beaten on them pretty hard, so they were taking losses, but also that they had a far greater threat from the Shia, and that if they fought this war against the United States, they would stagger out of it exhausted, and then the Shia would, meanwhile, have taken control completely of the country. So I think the Sunnis came to a rational conclusion that they were better off to get in the government and get what they could as opposed to fighting this life or death struggle. And then, of course, there was psychological aspects to it as well. I think in Afghanistan that's not unlike what can happen there. The Taliban are much more fragmented than they used to be. They're not the Taliban of 1996. And they are not credible with the Afghan people as a group or potential government. What they are is credible to the Afghan people as storm clouds on the horizon, as a threat to take away potential progress. Now, there are frustrations with the Afghan government. I mean, I'm the first to tell you that that's the biggest weakness. But they don't see the Taliban as a liberation. I do think that parts of the Taliban, however, could and probably should have a place in the political fabric of Afghanistan. I think it's necessary to pull as many of those in as you can, realizing that some of the more hardcore are unlikely to want to do that.
Now, post-traumatic stress disorder has become a significant problem for many returning soldiers and vets. Do you know people who've been affected? And have you any thoughts of how the military can better prevent and treat PTSD, both on the battlefield and when soldiers return home?
Yeah, I know a fair number of people who've been affected to different levels, and we're really talking about the PTSD that's not physical. You don't see it. It's not associated with a wound, although some people with physical wounds also have PTSD. I think one of the first things we can do is admit that it's hard, admit that soldiering is hard and that combat's hard. There's a certain level of macho, and I don't say that in a negative sense, but an ethos that says that admitting weakness is weak. And if you have something like PTSD, that for some reason means you weren't tough enough to take it. And that's not the case. I mean, the reality is the human psyche has a certain tolerance for challenges, and it's different in every person, and it doesn't mean you're less than anyone else. It just means that, you know, you need the stresses are worn on you. And I think the biggest thing that you can do for people is recognize that. Don't stigmatize it. Understand that the biggest thing that has reduced PTSD, or let me say this way, limited it as much as it has, is cohesion in units. It's the people on your right and left. It's understanding that the idea of the singleton, the Rambo who out there who fights alone and isn't scared, doesn't get weak, doesn't cry. I never met that person. I met people who need other people. Even some of the best operators I've ever known were strengthened by the moral strength of comrades and families. And I think we need to do that internal to the force, but then across the nation. You know, America sent these people to war. They sent these young men and women to war. Not the government of the United States. America did. Our families, our communities, our churches, our schools, we sent them to war. And when they come back, we are responsible for them, not a big government agency. And I think we've got to think that way.
Before you go, just one more question. I assume that you had to run this book by the Pentagon before it was published. Did you have to redact any information about the work of the Special Operations Forces because of worries of revealing something classified or sensitive?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I had worked coordinating with the government for 20 months of writing it to already reduce what we covered so that we didn't have any security concerns. The final review lasted 2 months. There was an initial review in which there were a number of redactions requested. We worked through every single case where the government asked for something to be taken out or something to be adjusted slightly so we could protect the well-being of our force. it was a long, detailed process, but I never ever thought of doing the book without doing it, because I think I owed it to my comrades. But I think the story absolutely maintains its cohesion. I think we were able to make the limited shaping to it to protect security without losing any of the drama or interest that readers, I hope, find.
General Stanley McChrystal is currently a senior fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, co-founder of the McChrystal Group, a leadership consulting firm. His memoir, My Share of the Task, is published by Portfolio Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I very much enjoyed it. Thank you.